Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along. Professor Irving makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. So we both survived the 2020 summit and she enjoyed it. So,
especially your company, Jared.
Helen Irving holds degrees in political science, anthropology, history and law. She currently teaches in the Faculty of Law at the University of Sydney. Professor Irving has taught political science and law at several Australian universities and was a visiting professor at Harvard Law School from 2005 to 2006. She is the author of To Constitute a Nation, A Cultural History of Australia's Constitution and Five Things to Know About the Australian Constitution. And she's also the editor of A Women's Constitution, Gender and History in the Australian Commonwealth, etc. And today she's going to talk about gender and the Constitution, equity and agency and comparative constitutional design, which has recently been launched by Cambridge University Press. Unfortunately, the books are in Melbourne and we couldn't get them here tonight, but we've got the author here tonight. And
we will sell them online.
And we will sell them online, so when we get them...
If anyone wants a copy, let me know and I'll keep you in mind.
Right. I'm losing control of this and we have an And so Professor Irving's going to talk to us tonight on why constitutions matter to women. Many thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. I'm delighted because I know that this is a... and that I will address this in my talk, a rather arcane topic for many people. So let me start with a general statement from the opening of chapter one of my book about why constitutions matter to women. A constitution is a powerful instrument. Indeed, in most countries, it is the supreme law sitting at the peak of the political and legal hierarchy. It is the source and the voice of power, both constitutive and authoritative. It sets out the legal and political structures for the country it governs. It identifies and names political and judicial offices and spheres of jurisdiction. It describes and establishes the arms of government and allocates powers between and among them. It also empowers and constrains the subsequent operation of government. Australians, however, generally do not understand the importance of constitutions. They tend not to recognise the power, both symbolic and functional, that a constitution can wield, or the immensely important role it can play in maintaining stability and assisting order and future confidence in a nation's life and, as a consequence, the life of individuals. They tend to think of the Australian Constitution, in the rare moments they think about it at all, as something that can continue to function without change or review or even the occasional dusting and airing. Paradoxically, of course, this complacency is a sign of the stability of our Constitution and of its relatively uncontroversial character. Our Constitution can work away, virtually invisible to the majority of people, doing what constitutions do, governing the distribution and exercise of power. George Eliot said that happy nations have no history. Perhaps happy nations also have no constitution, or at least appear not to have one. So to ask why constitutions matter to women is difficult in Australia, where we don't generally understand why constitutions matter at all. But this is not an obscure, specialist or provocative question in many parts of the world. In places where the importance of constitutions is already recognised, the importance of constitutions to women is increasingly under discussion. The question is treated seriously in much of the developed world, where a constitution already operates, and is certainly on the agenda everywhere, virtually everywhere, where new constitutions are being framed. Indeed, one of the primary reasons for this question is the huge growth in new constitutions in recent years, as democratisation has either been embraced or imposed on formerly undemocratic regimes, and as other countries seek to modernise their laws. More than half of the existing 200 or so constitutions in the world have been written since 1980. This trend is continuing. When I put the final touches on the text for my book around mid last year, the new Serbian constitution was, to my knowledge, the newest in the world. In less than a year since then, several others have been adopted or are undergoing drafting, Nepal and Ecuador, for example, the most recent. Others, such as the French constitution, have been significantly amended, and in the United Kingdom there is, once again, talk about writing a constitution. So real processes of thinking about the fundamental principles to be included in a constitution are happening right now, as we speak, and that is taking into account relevant international time differences. This, then, is not an abstract business. So I invite you to imagine what happens when a new constitution is drafted. Imagine sitting down with a blank piece of paper and a new pen poised above it. Where do you start? What words do you put first on the page? How are the choices made? Well, drafting isn't actually usually the start. It usually only begins after a process of agreement on broad goals has already been undergone. Often these goals are expressed in resolutions in which common values and commitments are captured. The actual drafting that follows then puts these commitments, and sometimes aspirations, into provisions that will work legally. This was the case in America at the end of the 18th century, in the Australian colonies at the end of the 19th century, in South Africa at the end of the 20th century, 100 years later, and it has probably been the case in most constitution-making processes in the world. In Australia, for example, it was agreed in the 1890s that the constitution they were going to write would enlarge the self-government of the colonies. It would be a constitution under the Crown. It would be federal. It would follow the US federal model. It would be democratic. In South Africa, the commitments were more detailed and there were more of them, and they included, among other things, the equality of men and women. So imagine we were writing a constitution in Australia today, in 2008. What fundamental principles or values might we commit ourselves to in advance? Let's say we agreed that our constitution was to be democratic, that one of our fundamental values was democracy. And I think it's a fair guess that we would actually get almost universal agreement on this. What then would follow? What constitutionally would be required in order for a country to be democratic? So here's my argument, the point of departure for my book. If one is committed to democratic constitution, and one asks the question, what does democracy require? An inescapable conclusion is that it requires gender equality. It requires a recognition of equality between women and men. Why is this? Well, I hope the answer is obvious to many of you, or to all of you, but I know it isn't to many people, at least. I know this because of the response I've had when describing the subject of my book. People have said to me, either directly or effectively, that to call for gender equality to be a core principle in the democratic constitution, or to assess constitutions from the perspective of how they serve the interests of gender equality, is to engage in a special type of pleading, or to promote identity politics, or to go down the path of a sort of loopy or hostile deconstructionism or postmodernism in my approach to the law. My simple answer is this. The ordinary, unthreatening, uncomplicated principles of liberal democracy lead to the conclusion that gender equality is essential. Modern democracy rests upon equality, upon representative government and majority decision-making, at least for most decisions. A democratic constitution must require, sustain and enforce gender equality. This principle is no more complicated than the principle that in the political sphere, democracy these days requires women to have the right to vote. I have to remind people, as I had to remind myself from time to time in writing this book, that women are not a minority. They are an equal majority in most parts of the world and an absolute majority in some. Minorities, of course, need attention, and no democracy and no democratic constitution can claim the title of democratic and simply enforce majority views on minorities. But as I write in my book, although women's experience as historically subordinated human beings has much in common with the experience of minorities, it cannot be analogized with this experience, either jurisprudentially or practically, nor should women's status be conceptualized as that of a minority. Women are half of the world, half of each nation. This is not just a slogan or a naive observation about statistics. It is a fundamental, indeed ontological, observation. Now, the recognition that women and men are equal majorities is, of course, not all there is to democracy. It does not even exhaust the search for constitutional expression of the goal of gender equality. I adopt a liberal democratic framework in my book, a framework in which equality is itself a value and where individual freedom and the opportunity to maximise individual potential are central. However, I also acknowledge that there are differences between men and women, and to think about these in constitutional terms is not merely a matter of writing in the preamble of a constitution a commitment to equality and including in the constitutional text a provision prohibiting discrimination on the grounds of sex or gender. It is well known that simple formal equality is not enough. Formal equality, that is, treating persons alike without distinction, as we do, for example, with the right to vote these days, may also in some cases produce or reinforce inequalities. That is, to treat all persons equally, regardless of gender, by offering them identical gender-neutral treatment or subjecting them to identical laws, may work against the goal of equality. Formal equality will often work only where people are similarly situated. It may be counter-egalitarian where people are not. Substantive equality or affirmative action, it has long been accepted, may be needed to redress this. Constitutional arrangements that do not take this into account, that do not take into account the difference between parts of the majority, will tend to assist inequality. The Canadian Constitution, to give an example, includes a provision prohibiting discrimination on the ground of, amongst others, sex. It also adds a qualification to this, stating that the provision prohibiting discrimination does not preclude any law, program, or activity that has as its object the amelioration of conditions of disadvantaged individuals or groups, including those that are disadvantaged because of, among other things, sex. This then allows for special measures that are designed to achieve equality but are not offered equally to all. So the ordinary principles of liberal democracy, which I support, the John Stuart Mill type principles, require gender equality. But women and men are nevertheless different, and some of the ways in which they are different require different treatment and are relevant to constitutional design. Women are also different from each other, but they are also relevantly similar in ways that also make them different from men. Women, unlike men, have in common a shared experience of historical oppression. Women historically have been denied entitlements available to men. They have been placed in positions of subordination and excluded from many spheres of life. Even today, when in the Western democratic world the battle for legal and political equality has been largely won, they remain subject to indirect discrimination. They are underrepresented in positions of power and influence and are often undervalued. One doesn't have to be deeply knowledgeable or particularly radical to know this. This type of difference, it is hoped, is mutable, changeable, can change. Much progress has been made in reducing sex discrimination, at least in some parts of the world, and further progress can be urged, even expected. But even in an ideal future where arbitrary discrimination and stereotyping have vanished, women will still be different from men. They will continue to have in common the fact of their reproductive capacity. Even the complete achievement of formal equality would leave them different in this respect. The development of medical knowledge and technologies will alter the actual experience of reproduction, in some cases, but it will not alter this fact of gender difference. This endures independently of the many cultural practices and prejudices surrounding reproduction that might one day also be eliminated. It endures despite progress in the degree to which women can control their fertility. This is, of course, not a matter, I hope you'll accept this, of saying that biology is destiny. The fact that women bear children and that men do not is a critical, permanent difference. A constitution that seeks gender equality as one of its core goals will also need to take this into account. So what I set out to do, beginning with the assumption that gender equality is critical to democratic constitutionalism, and notwithstanding differences of race, ethnicity, sexuality, etc., among women, that women are similar, was to think about the ways in which constitutions either reinforce gender equalities or can be used to inequalities or can be used to assist equality. In fact, I began to think about the different ways in which a country's constitution affects men and women differently some years ago when working on the history of Australia's Federation and finding that women in the 1890s had views about the constitution while it was being framed, and that they made efforts, indeed, to influence the drafting of the Constitution, some of which left their traces in the Constitution itself. I also discovered that women in the colonies had organised themselves into lobby groups for and against Federation and had been active in public campaigns and debates, including taking part in referendum campaigns on the proposed Constitution. At a time where, in almost nowhere else in the world, women had the right to vote, women in two of the Australian colonies were among the voters in the referendums themselves. All of these and other initiatives were taken at a time when previously it was assumed by historians and lawyers alike women played no role at all. Indeed, it was assumed that they were silent in the constitution-making process in Australia. I discussed these historical findings in my first edited book called A Woman's Constitution and subsequently in a chapter of my book called To Constitute a Nation. The role of women became accepted as part of the Federation story. Indeed, it was included in most centenary Federation histories and in much of the school's educational material developed around that time. Australians thus were ready to acknowledge what had previously been overlooked, that women were part of our own constitution-making story, and that women's perspective on the design of the then new constitution was, at least in some respects, distinctive and different from men's. Having had the satisfaction of seeing this research become accepted, then transformed into something commonplace and routine, I began to wonder if the historical gendered analysis of a constitution could be accepted. Why was the idea of a modern woman's perspective on the constitution thought a bit loopy? My next opportunity to think about such matters occurred in early 2005, when, along with a leading political scientist in the United Kingdom, Professor Vivian Hart, I was commissioned by the United Nations Development Programme to write a paper on gender equity and constitution making with respect specifically to Iraq. This paper, as with a number of others they commissioned, was prepared in case the Iraqis, who were at that time engaged in their own post-Saddam constitution making, in case they were seeking advice or assistance on aspects of constitutional design. The Americans were putting pressure on Iraq to write a constitution that was not inconsistent with gender equality, and the United Nations shared that goal. I don't know whether our paper was read or followed by the constitution's framers, but it certainly focused my thinking on ways in which a constitution matters to women. In existing literature on democratic constitution making, it was already well accepted at the time that women needed to be involved in the processes of writing and adopting a constitution. The legitimacy of the finished constitution, the sense of ownership by the population, and the likelihood of a constitution's success depend, it is understood, upon wide participation among all of those who are to be members of the new constitutional community. As women are an equal majority with men, any constitution, these days at least, that represented only the voices of men could not be regarded as legitimate. Further, it was recognised that special initiatives were needed to ensure that women's participation, to ensure women's participation in constitution making, especially in less developed parts of the world, where, for example, women's literacy levels are significantly lower than men's. It was all very well, however, to emphasise the importance of encouraging women's involvement. But a constitution doesn't just emerge from a participatory process. It is a document, a legal instrument. It consists of words. It has to be written. Agreement may well be reached that the widest participation is needed in the constitution-making processes for a constitution to be democratic and thus legitimate. Agreement may also be reached about the values or commitments that are to be captured in it, but a choice still has to be made about the words that go on the page. So if women got the opportunity to take part in the writing itself, what would they want? And how would we find out what they want? I looked at several sources. There were records of women's historical demands going back at least to the mid-19th century, and also some very recent world examples of women's organisation and participation in other countries' constitutional processes. Women had been involved in the processes surrounding the adoption of Canada's new Charter of Rights and Freedoms in 1982. Women had taken part in the South African process of post-apartheid constitution making in the early 1990s, in Kenya in the early 2000s, in Nigeria, in Rwanda, and in other parts of the world. They had organised meetings and forums and left a record of the things they wanted in their country's constitution. So there was a small but useful record of women's demands for a gender-friendly constitution. And there were, I found, surprising commonalities among these perspectives in different parts of the world. A year after Vivian Hart and I wrote the Iraqi paper, I found myself still thinking about these matters, and I decided first to turn that thinking into a course that I taught at Harvard Law School in the start of 2006. And I taught subsequently at Sydney Law School on a course on gender and constitution making. Some of my students, who participated wonderfully in what was an experimental course, are here in the audience. In between the Harvard and the Sydney courses, I decided to turn the thinking into a book. This book is the first, to my knowledge, the first full attempt at creating a framework for writing a new constitution with the goal of gender equality in mind, and also for gender auditing existing constitutions. Now, it might be assumed that a constitutional statement of gender equality rights or a prohibition on gender discrimination would be all or most of what was needed for a gender-friendly constitution. Some might indeed think that gender rights and prohibition on discrimination are the start and finish of the gender equality constitutional challenge. But designing a constitution to include gender equality is not merely a matter of opening a gate and saying all are welcome to come in, regardless of whether you are a woman or a man. Constitutional rights, I argue, are only one consideration among many. Indeed, although gender equality rights are almost universally accepted as necessary in a modern constitution and cannot be overlooked, there are good reasons to be a little wary about depending on rights, especially if you are a woman. Still, I accepted that it would be quite unrealistic to recommend that equality rights should be left out of a new constitution if gender equality was a goal. All the same, gender equality in a constitution is about much more than rights. Many other things have to be taken into account. The enforcement of constitutional rights only arises after many other steps have already occurred. Decisions have to be taken about the constitutional design of the institution in which the judges who interpret and enforce the rights are appointed and work, through which the rights they review are framed, through which the laws that are framed are put into effect, and through which the lawmakers themselves are chosen. In other words, a lot goes on before constitutional equality rights come into play, and many opportunities for women's equality have been presented or denied before then. Borrowing and adapting from political science literature, I referred to what I was looking for as constitutional opportunity structures, ways in which the institutions of government and law are shaped and operate so as to facilitate opportunities to take part in decision-making and processes of change. What then were the things one needed to think about in assessing whether a constitution facilitated or obstructed women's opportunities to participate, and even without participation, to be full members of the constitutional community? So I began from the beginning, from the hypothetical moment of sitting down with the blank paper and pen, starting the drafting of a constitution, assuming that agreement had been reached beforehand about the broad principles and commitments to be followed, and assuming that those included gender equality. In the beginning, of course, is the word. As I wrote in my second chapter, a constitution is made up of words, and the words have to be chosen with great care, particularly because constitutions are usually difficult to amend. They are intended to be difficult. They are intended to be more or less inflexible. Their words are intended to endure. These words will be interpreted by judges on constitutional courts now and in the future, and will come to have a life of their own. So what should one look for in the wording itself from the perspective of gender equality? Well, not a great deal had been written about this stage of constitution making, or about what is actually involved in the experience of choosing the words, and even less was written about what is involved when one is committed to gender equality. But fortunately, there were a couple of accounts, including a very valuable description by Christina Murray, who was a member of the South African Constitution drafting team for the post-apartheid constitution that took effect in 1996. In her account, which had a section entitled Getting the Words Right, she describes the efforts they made, among other things, to find words that reflected their commitment to gender equality. There was also literature regarding the legal effect of gendered words, gendered pronouns in particular, and of rules of statutory interpretation governing gendered words, which was helpful. There were also some wonderful historical examples that showed how interpretation of even apparently gender-neutral words could have a discriminatory effect. My favourite of these examples is the Canadian Persons Case, as it's called. Let me give you a flavour of this. The Canadian Constitution of 1867, the British North America Act, included within it a provision for the appointment of senators to the Senate. In describing the appointment, it used the expression qualified persons. In 1927, Emily Murphy, who had been appointed in Alberta in 1916 as Canada's first woman magistrate, joined with four other women, making up what is subsequently called the Famous Five, to petition for a Canadian Supreme Court interpretation of the Constitution on women's eligibility to serve as senators. Murphy's right to serve as a magistrate had already been unsuccessfully challenged in the Supreme Court of Alberta. She had been proposed as a Senate appointee on more than one occasion, but it was assumed by the government that the Constitution precluded a woman's appointment. Acting on the petition, the Minister, Canadian Minister for Justice, asked the Supreme Court of Canada to rule on the question, does the word person in Section 24 of the Constitution include female persons? The following year, the Supreme Court answered in the negative. The Constitution, the Supreme Court of Canada said, had to be interpreted in the light of the meaning at the time that it was written. This meant that women in 1867, for the purposes of serving positions of government, were not persons. Now, this is a very interesting case because it has a happy ending. The case was then appealed to the Privy Council in London. The Privy Council interpreted the word differently. Its meaning, the judges said, did not lie in its history, but in the progressive meaning it had today, in what was then the 1920s. The Constitution, they said, using a famous expression, what became a famous expression, had planted in Canada a living tree capable of growth and expansion within its natural limits. To those who ask why the word person should not include females, the judges said, the obvious answer is, why should it not? Thus, women came to be appointable to the Canadian Senate, although Emily Murphy, sadly, was never appointed. Now, I was also able to draw on accounts left by various female judges in the United States and in Canada of what it was like to serve on their constitutional court or other court. And while I was at Harvard, I also spoke with and had a great conversation with the current Chief Justice of Massachusetts, Margaret Marshall. Some of these women judges' accounts were responses to the question that is often asked, at least in some circles I move in, does it make a difference if judges are men or women? The most common response from the judges themselves was this: it makes a difference not in all types of case and not to the outcomes or conclusions of the case, but to the type of reasoning or thinking that informs the judgment. Chief Justice Marshall was absolutely blunt when I tentatively asked her that question, does it make a difference? Of course it makes a difference, she said. Our experience informs our thinking. The experience of being a woman is different from being a man. Well, in the past, in my own formalist equality days, I used to think that this was wrong. That gender, the different gender experience, was itself just a product of cultural and social stereotyping. I no longer think this, and in any case, who was I to disagree with the Chief Justice? But I concluded anyway that it didn't really matter whether women brought a different perspective to the bench or not. What mattered was that for gender equality to be achieved, women must be able to be appointed to the bench in the first place. As judges do the interpretation of a constitution's words, the processes by which individuals end up on a country's constitutional court are vital. I considered, therefore, whether the constitutional rules for appointment facilitated or obstructed the appointment, rules and processes facilitated or obstructed the appointment of women. It was not just the rules of appointment that counted, but also rules governing, for example, retirement, age of retirement. Early retirement, for example, may create obstacles for women's appointment in societies, as is still the case in Australia, where women reach seniority in the legal profession later than men. On the other hand, very late retirement or life appointment, as used to be the case in Australia and is the case in the United States, means a lower rate of turnover in judicial appointments and fewer opportunities for women. It also means that the views of the bench are in many cases like light from a distant star. What is reflected is actually coming from the past, and progressive ideas about the place of women run ahead of it. The South African Constitution, which gave me many solutions to dilemmas of this kind, having confronted this paradox itself, the drafters having confronted it, had a very effective solution. This constitution includes a retirement age alternatively of either 70 or a maximum non-renewable 12-year term for constitutional court judges. It is notable, however, that the South African Constitutional Court is not gender egalitarian in its composition. Only two women currently sit on an 11-judge court. The court's racial composition is much more egalitarian, but gender has not yet caught up. And this illustrates, of course, what we must not lose sight of, that constitutions don't work of their own accord, and they cannot by themselves reverse social and cultural discrimination or disadvantage, no matter how well drafted they are and no matter how ingenious their provisions are. I also needed to think about the other side of the bench. What is it like to appear before the judges? How does constitutional litigation proceed? What in particular are the rules that govern who is able to bring a case before the court, the rules of standing? Do these rules work equally for men and women? Is access to the constitutional court expensive, or is information about how to gain access difficult to find or read? Do tests for standing rest upon having personal economic interests in a matter? Is legal aid limited or restricted only to criminal cases, where men are disproportionately overrepresented? In thinking about these questions, we should remind ourselves that in every country, but in developing and post-conflict countries in particular, women are disproportionately represented among the poorest sections of society. They constitute the overwhelming majority of supporting parents in single-parent households, and that's related to poverty. They are less likely to own property in their own right, and more likely to be illiterate and uneducated. Of course, the laws that are reviewed in the light of a constitution's words, as interpreted by judges appointed to a constitutional court, must first be passed by the country's legislature. And so I asked similar questions about the way in which a constitution might obstruct or facilitate women's participation in government. These include not only electoral processes and electoral laws, but also the sorts of indirect disincentives we still find in our otherwise formally egalitarian systems of election. For example, the rules or the standing orders that govern sitting times or parliamentary sessions, so that members of parliament often have to go for days on end without seeing their children, let alone putting them to bed at night. Now, such rules should be a disincentive to men as well as to women, but they may act disproportionately as a disincentive to women even to consider standing for Parliament in the first place. And in some parts of the world, those rules are being taken into account in the Scottish Constitution, for example, and the Scottish processes of Parliament. position that women, position that parents are with respect to responsibilities for children has been taken into consideration. Opportunities to take part in government and to be full members of the constitutional community are closely related also to conditions surrounding the acquisition, retention and transmission of citizenship. Women have been especially vulnerable historically to loss of citizenship. And at the same time, citizenship as a legal status is especially important for women. Despite lofty ideas we might have about what comes with being a citizen, and confidence we might have intuitively, at least, about the security of holding citizenship, women have historically been denied the entitlements of citizens, and they have also been especially susceptible to loss of citizenship. Everyone knows that in the United States, citizenship is gained by a simple fact of birth in the US territory. And many know that the Constitution, the 14th Amendment, sets this out. What many do not know, including many Americans, is that between 1907 and 1922, or 1931 for women of Asian origin, American women lost what we might consider to be their constitutional birthright citizenship upon marriage to an alien. This included all aliens, including English people, Englishmen. In cases where such women could not acquire the citizenship of their husband, they were rendered stateless. Indeed, the majority of stateless persons in the United States in the 20th century were American women married to alien men. This denaturalization upon alien marriage was not unique to the United States. It applied around the British Empire and in many other parts of the world for decades. A legal inability on the part of women to transmit citizenship to their children in their own right was also the case in similar countries. In Britain until recently, and this is the case in other parts of the world now, in Britain until recently, when British women whose children were born abroad could not automatically transmit their citizenship, where British men in a similar situation could. An unmarried British mother whose child was born abroad was unable to transmit her citizenship until even more recently. Similar laws could be found in Canada and in the United States, for example. And interestingly, the situation is now reversed in those countries. Unmarried citizen fathers whose child is born overseas are now unable automatically to transmit their citizenship. This too, of course, is an example of gender discrimination needing attention. And what we know from these examples is that a guarantee of constitutional citizenship has to go beyond just a statement about how it is acquired. In the book, I have, of course, also addressed equality rights in detail and, as a separate chapter, reproductive rights. I also discussed the role played by international law in a country's constitution with respect to gender equality and, one of the most challenging questions, the place of customary or religious law. In these chapters, I confront the fact that rights collide, that cultural rights and rights to religious freedom, among others, will at times clash with principles of gender equality. Now, my analysis, as I've been telling you, is based on principles of liberal democracy and liberal equality. In the end, when a choice has to be made between constitutional provisions protecting cultural or religious rights and gender equality provisions, in cases where these clash, my conclusion had to be gender equality prevails. Well, this, I was pleased to find, was the solution adopted in South Africa's constitution. The framers had experienced a big battle between proponents, mostly male tribal leaders, of prioritising cultural rights, and proponents, mostly women, black and white, of prioritising equality. They opted finally for the latter. The Constitution includes a section of the South African Constitution protecting freedom of cultural or religious choice and prohibiting cultural or religious discrimination. But it also includes the statement that these rights may not be exercised in a manner inconsistent with any provision of the Bill of Rights, and the Bill of Rights includes gender equality. My book concludes, and I've just given you a sort of an overview of some of the themes, concludes with an exploration of processes of constitutional amendment. But I would like to conclude here with another observation. Constitutions can be fine and beautiful things. They cannot be too aspirational or poetic, but they have a power that transcends the ordinariness of their words. For all this, they are not magical. They cannot work without a culture that supports their aspirations. They cannot work without cooperative institutions of government. They also cannot and should not become too sacred. Their words should not be frozen. They should continue to be challenged, to be criticised, and to be progressively developed. On the other hand, the democratic egalitarian constitution should also retain its core commitments, and among these must be the fundamental equality of women and men. When Australians rewrite their constitution, as I hope they will one day, when they come to understand the importance of constitutions, I hope they will also understand this principle.
Thanks, Dr. Irving. And as we were saying earlier, Anne will put up on our, I think it'll go out as an email how to get the book when the books arrive. So if for some reason you're in the audience and you're not on our list and you're interested, just let Anne or myself know at the end of the discussion question period, which now commences and will conclude no later than 7 o'clock. So here we go. Question in the front row.
Yes. Positing agreement, a general agreement on your form, or on your formulation of gender equality, on what criteria would you explicitly set that out within a constitution as opposed to a sub-constitutional instrument?
That's too large a question. I think I have to say you need to read the book because that's it.
Okay. If you just talk to the end
of the
room.
That's the whole sort of thrust of the book is setting out... I do discuss, whether I persuade you or not, I don't know, but I discuss in the introduction and in the chapter called Framework what I consider to be the tests, the measures, the criteria for gender equality. But I don't, if what you're asking is how will I know when it's been achieved, I don't know if that's your question, that's a difficult question that can't be answered in advance of actually attempting to work out how it should be protected in the first place. So really I can't answer any better than that other than to say, get the book. The problem with the book, I should point out, is it was published in America. And so we had a bit of a sort of a desperate race to try and get some copies here in order for them to be available. And as illustration of my statement about the fact that Australians don't tend to see this as an important topic, sorry, excluding all of you here, the booksellers in Australia really have hardly ordered any copies in at all. There are probably sort of half a dozen in the whole of Australia, and four of them were ordered by me. bookshop in Phillip Street. There are two copies in the bookshop in Phillip Street. This is a little bit of self-promotion. Ten was sent sort of urgently from New York, but they were sent to Melbourne, so
we can get them here in a day or two.
But at any rate, so I'm sorry I can't read the paper. Just say, read the book. You'll see. And as I say in the book, you know, this is not meant to be the final word. This is meant to open up discussion and exploration and lead, one hopes, to more exploration of the relationship between gender equality and constitutional design.
Yeah.
And
so, based on all of that, what needs to be done to our own constitution if it's to have any effect on equality or gender...
Yeah,
gender balance. I mean, most of the changes to rules of voting in that came through the Parliament.
First of all,
what's left?
Distinction has to be made between what you put in a constitution and what is constitutional in the broader sense. And I really focused mostly, although not exclusively, mostly on the actual instrument itself, because of taking that sort of that real experience of thinking about what it is you would need to actually write into the constitution. You don't want to be writing too much, but you don't want to write too little. So a lot of the actual processes themselves are unconstitutional in that they have to be left to the sort of the political realm. I don't want to de-emphasise the political at all. In fact, quite the contrary. But what would we need? Just going through our chapters here, my chapters, we need to look at the language of the Constitution. It is not gender-inclusive language. And the idea that you can really have male-gendered language masquerading as universal language is actually a false one. It's false legally in many cases as well as conceptually. I haven't talked about this, but there's a chapter here on federalism. Now, that may seem a really curious topic to subject to a gender analysis. This is one of the areas in which in the United States there's actually a reasonable amount of feminist literature on constitutions, on the way in which the distribution of powers in a federal system has a constitutional impact. We could certainly look at that. I'd have to read the whole chapter to persuade you. But citizenship, we don't have provisions in our constitution protecting the retention of or transmission of citizenship. In fact, we have some rather adverse laws regarding citizenship in Australia, and we have a pretty open slather. That's something that I think needs attention. We need to look at, obviously, our formal electoral systems are not in egalitarian in a formal sense, but we need to look certainly at the standing orders and the rules governing the parliamentary process from the perspective not just of women's participation, but of the participation, equal participation of men and women with respect to their family responsibilities. And there is a constitutional provision in the Australian Constitution that indirectly entrenches a very old-fashioned model of parliamentary procedure. We clearly don't have gender equality rights in our constitution. We don't have rights, and this is something that I have some hesitation about because I think there are problems with constitutionalising rights, but there are ways perhaps in which it can be done which minimise some of the problems. The whole sphere of reproductive rights is a terribly fraught and difficult one because one wants to have protection of reproductive choice at the same time as protection of maternity, protection of mothers and protection of the health of unborn children and so on, and one has to, it's a very hard balance to strike. I would go on. So basically my answer is a range of things.
And we'll
hang on just a second. We've got to move it. Now, when you talk, we just talk to the back of the room.
Yeah.
Pretend everyone's out on
Phillips Street. But I was going to ask me a question.
It doesn't matter. No. Pretend she's out on Phillips Street.
Okay.
No, you don't need to be polite here. We all... doesn't work. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it seems to be one of the problems in Australia. If a woman stands for Parliament, she's judged on her hair. When Bishop came to talk to us, I thought, what an intelligent woman. But always in the paper, it was she'd been having a bad hair day.
Yeah. Yes, I don't know whether the Constitution can do much about that, but it's sort of a constitutional culture or a constitution that is sensitive to gender equality might be part of or bring home the serious point about genuine ways of understanding women's participation and evaluating women's participation.
Okay, let's go to here. 1, 2, 3. Yeah. Yep.
You said that there isn't much of a market for your book here at the moment.
Not yet.
You implied that there's one in North America. And I wondered why, given that the USA overall arguably is a more conservative society than ours, and other than that there's more people there, why would there be more of a market there than you?
Well, there are a lot more people in America. So even if the per capita interest is the same, there's a lot more capita in America than there are in Australia. And, of course, publishers have sales in mind before they publish anything. But feminist law in North America is much more developed. There are a lot more law schools, there are a lot more lawyers, there are a lot more legal academics, and there are a lot of feminist lawyers in the United States, and lots of courses dealing with feminism law. There are in Australia as well, a good number, although I think mine was the only one specifically on constitutions and gender. But there is a more active sense of interest in constitutional debates in those countries, perhaps because the conservatism gets the non-conservative perspective sort of worked up a bit more as well. A whole constellation of factors, but there's certainly, it's not the best, my bestseller, on the New York Times list, but there's certainly a lot better prospects, market prospects than there are here.
Well, the Americans spend a lot more time discussing
these kind of issues.
Well, they're also very attuned to constitutional debates as well. And there have been leading constitutional cases in which questions about the equal protection of the laws with respect to men and women have really been...
They have a Bill of Rights, so they argue about it, whereas we don't. So there's a question there, then we go down here.
You mentioned Australian women trying to have some influence on the early Australian constitution. Could you tell us any points that they were trying to make in that?
Okay, well, there are a couple of... they're making broad points, but if you are looking for specific instances in the constitution where women's debates and lobbying left their mark, the issue of the suffrage, the women's right to vote, suffrage groups, the activities of suffrage groups, this is what made me think that women had to have a view about the processes of writing the constitution in the 1890s, because I knew that women were very active in suffrage movements, campaigning for the right to vote in those colonies where they didn't have it. Because of their campaigns, women gained the right to vote in South Australia before the constitution was written. And there's a trace of that in the constitution. It's not a provision that has terribly much effect today, but there's a provision that basically says if you've got the right to vote already in a colony, you can't be deprived of that right by the Commonwealth once the Commonwealth begins. Now, that went in because the South Australians who were at the Federal Convention, who were elected by men and women, insisted that the right to vote of women in South Australia should be protected. There are also provisions, and this is one that has a wonderful, rich story to it, and I try to tell it a little bit in the chapter on federalism, about there's a provision there allowing for the states of Australia to regulate the trade in alcohol. Despite the fact that there's a very important provision in the Constitution that guarantees effectively free trade amongst the states, there's an exception for trade in alcohol. Now, that went in, it wasn't an exclusively women's issue, but there was a very powerful women's temperance movement in the 1890s, supported by men in the Federal Convention. Temperance was an issue that really... that really crystallised a lot of women's experience and radicalised and politicised a lot of women in that period around the world, in America as well as in Australia. And temperance was, as we know, fought out. It was a very hard-fought constitutional matter in the United States. So that section in the Australian Constitution reflects women's campaign to... predominantly women's campaigns to have... alcohol trade exempted from the guarantee of free trade, and there are other little traces as well, which show that their stamp was there. It wouldn't have been there if it hadn't been for women's campaigns.
Question down there. Yeah.
Helen, the what you rationalised presumably is a duality of gender between you're either male or female.
Mm-hmm.
What about the issue of ambiguous gender? There's a notion that, for example, this gender could be regarded as a continuum rather than a duality.
Mm-hmm.
And according to recent figures, birth figures, it would suggest that the numbers of people, for example, in Australia who are born with ambiguous gender is probably in the tens of thousands, so it's not necessarily a small minority. Should the Constitution be mindful of those sorts of changes?
Well, I think that a democracy should protect the interests of all persons, ideally, and should certainly protect all persons from arbitrary and disadvantageous discrimination. And that would apply to persons of uncertain sexuality or transgendered persons. But my concern in the book, as I hope was clear at the start, was making the egalitarian argument purely and simply within the sort of the simple framework of what... Of the majoritarian perspective of a democracy. And it's not to say a democracy is only about majorities, but it's a pretty fundamental core part of egalitarianism according to the liberal democratic framework. And so whilst there are big differences across any group of women, big differences across any group of men, and no doubt there are also other differences between men and in between men and women, those are nevertheless still perspectives of a minority. And I think it's very important for a case to be made for looking at constitutions with respect to how they protect minorities from discrimination, and also permit special measures to be taken to redress disadvantage or discrimination suffered by minorities. That's just not the thing in my book.
Now, I haven't read your book yet because it's not here. But
well, as soon as it arrives.
Oh, right, yeah, sure. But the question I'm interested in is militant Islam, which is going to be an increasing issue, not only in authoritarian societies, but also in some democracies, the issue of Sharia law, and this, of course, is particularly a problem for women as to their ability to travel or do basic, undertake what would be regarded as basic democratic rights. To what extent do you think that militant Islam is going to be an issue in gender, in democratic societies and other societies, and how will that be resolved?
Well, it's an issue, that's for sure. It's all very well to say, as I will say in response to you, to the end of the room, one has to assert fundamentalist egalitarian, gender egalitarian principles as at the end of the day when it comes to a clash between other principles and gender equality. Now, it's easy to say that, but of course, in practice, there one has to be much more nuanced than that. And there are examples in South Africa, for example, and other countries where failure to recognise customary rights leads to gender inequality. So this is an indirect answer, but I'll get to you to your question more directly in a second. In South Africa, a lot of marriages are customary marriages. And if customary law was not recognised under the constitution, or the recognition of it was excluded by other constitutional provisions, that would have placed women who were married according to customary law in the position of not having their marriage legally recognised, and that would create all sorts of disadvantage, including with respect to the legitimacy of children or the entitlements of their children, including under customary law. So a very careful formula had to be found to protect women from, if we're just thinking about gender equality at the moment because there are other issues other than this, but to protect women from the perverse effects of prioritising modern principles of legal equality. So with respect to any sort of question about whether Islamic law or Sharia law should be recognised in systems like Australia, one would want to be sensitive to those sorts of outcomes where you actually reproduce disadvantage. On the other hand, I think that it's problematic because you can say, well, let's prioritise choice, so let's allow those, including women, who choose to opt into systems, cultural systems or systems of cultural law that don't follow the sort of principles, modern principles of equality. Let's allow them to make that choice. Let's prioritise that part of the sort of the liberal democratic framework, the choice part, and then let them then place themselves in a position where they no longer make the other choices that follow in a liberal democratic society. The problem is there, the nature of choice. So if choice is not free in the way that proponents of choice often suggest. So that's not a simple solution either. I think really I just have to come back to what I said, which is about customary and religious law, which is where you have a clash, a clear cut clash between modern principles of gender equality and customary law, which is protected in a constitution. Where you have a clash of any rights or of any provisions in the Constitution, you have to have a tiebreaker. That's well recognised in federal systems, where you have a clash between Commonwealth and state law and so on. You have a tiebreaker, and the tiebreaker, in my view, has to be one which prioritises gender equality. There are some women in the United States who now describe themselves as fundamentalist, egalitarian feminists. I think I'm tending in that direction.
we're just going to be very brief and a very quick answer.
At the 2020 convention, was anything discussed about constitutional change as it affects gender? And if so, did anything go forward about it?
I raised it. In the very first, I was asked in the governance group to make a statement about what my ideas were for under the governance theme. And I said, let's have a complete review of our constitution from all sorts of perspectives, including with respect to gender equality. I think that was the one and only time it was mentioned.
I wasn't there at the time. It was probably with the facilitator, so you probably, if you go look for the butcher paper and blue packet, maybe on it.
I did stick up a little thing about gender equality.
In an archive somewhere in a few years' time.
Okay, many thanks. Take a seat. Just gone 7 o'clock, and we always finish on time. Anne and I've got a great admiration for Professor Irving because she's been here before, and no doubt she'll come back again. Because she's one of those academics who've got a very clear idea of how government works, how politics works, how the system works outside the university. So it's great to hear someone who's got time to reflect and to write on important topics, but also to be able to explain them to a general audience like this and to raise important issues. So it's great that you're here tonight. Best wishes for the success of the book. In the meantime, we'll have it up on.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.